You're listening to the EPL Talk Podcast. He's one of the most famous officials to have refereed in the English Premier League. He's been in charge of FA Cup finals and has gotten into many heated battles on the pitch with the greats of the game. And now he's here to tell us his story. His name is Jeff Winter, and he's our guest today on episode 54. First, the news. So, the EPL Talk podcast is back. It's a little bit delayed this week. I was away this weekend for a trip to Orlando, Florida, and just got back. And, of course, I went away for a weekend, and look what happened. It was quite an eventful weekend in the Premiership, with lots of goals flying in, and some huge results for teams such as Wigan and Charlton, and unfortunately not so much for Watford. And then the Carling Cup final, and what an eventful game that was. But rather than dwell on the past, we're going to look to the future. And we're going to look at this weekend's matches, the fixtures. And this is probably going to be one of the biggest weekends of the Premiership between now and the end of the season. At this point in the season, every game matters. Looking at Saturday's fixtures, you have, of course, the big one starting off on Saturday morning, Eastern time at 7:45, is Liverpool against Manchester United at Old Trafford. Of course, this is a massive match for Manchester United. If they can win this one, they will go 12 points ahead of Chelsea, who are in second place. Chelsea doesn't play until noon Eastern time on that day. Liverpool, meanwhile, at home have been fantastic. They haven't let a goal in I believe it's about 14 and a half hours. So it's going to be a tough team to beat, especially after the win against Barcelona and also that 4-0 drubbing of Sheffield United. But we'll have to wait and see to see what happens in that match. In the other matches, we've got Arsenal against Reading, which would be very, very enticing and could end up being maybe a match that helps decide who cements that fourth place. Is it Arsenal, or can Reading catch up and knock Arsenal off their perch? In other matches too, it's a derby weekend. So you have, for example, you have Newcastle United in the big northeast derby against Middlesbrough on Saturday. You also have the Lancashire Derby with Manchester City against Wigan. Then you have the big relegation battle, and that's Watford against Charlton. And Watford, pretty much at this point, look dead and buried. But this is probably the last real hope of trying to surmount a basically kind of a push to get out of that relegation zone. But it doesn't look good, and you have to think that Charlton can go to this to Vicarage Road and get the 3 points there. And then just in some of the other matches too, you have Bolton against Blackburn, another Lancashire derby that's on Sunday, West Ham United against Spurs, a London derby on Sunday, crucial match for West Ham United here, and again, if they don't win this one, it's going to sink them down closer to being relegated and give Spurs a bit of a lift, maybe into the top seven or eight perhaps with a win there. So it's a great Premiership weekend to look forward to, without a doubt. Coming up in this episode, we have an interview with Jeff Winter, the former Premiership referee, just in a little bit. And we also give you a chance to win a copy of Jeff Winter's book called Who's the Bastard in the Black? Plus, we have a conversation with guest host Brian Koski, who discusses which clubs might be coming up from the Championship League to the Premiership, and exciting news about a new podcast affiliated with EPL Talk. Plus, we'll be announcing the winner of the Pro Evolution Soccer 2007 video game, and we have a ton of news to get to later on in this episode. So this week's guest is Jeff Winter, the former Premiership football referee. And Jeff is one of the most outspoken referees out there. He's come out quite a bit and talked about some of the controversial decisions. And you often see him on Sky Sports giving his input there. Jeff is originally from the Northeast and is a Middlesbrough supporter, and perhaps his finest match in charge was the 2004 FA Cup final between Manchester United and Millwall, which ended up being his final game in charge as a professional referee before he retired. So before we go over to the interview with Jeff, I do want to mention too that we're going to be giving away a copy of his book. So stay tuned later on in this episode to find out how to win that. And here's the interview. So it's an honour to have on the line with us Jeff Winter from the Middlesbrough area of England and the former Premiership referee. How are you doing this morning, Jeff?
Very well. Saw a great game of football last night. Since I gave up refereeing, I'm now, as well as mainly after dinner speaking, I'm working for a local radio station over here, 96.6 TFM, and we cover Hartlepool and Darlington in Division 2 and Middlesbrough in the Premiership. And last night, Hartlepool and Darlington were both at home, and I was at the Hartlepool game, an absolutely fantastic game. They won 3-2 with a free kick in the last couple of minutes. So things are pretty good over here. They're 17 matches unbeaten, Darlington 8, and Middlesbrough not doing so badly either. So it's a good time to be a football fan where I live at the moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely enjoy it while you can. You never know when it'll
last. I'm sure the run will come to an end sooner rather than later.
So I wanted to kick off by asking Jeff, what can listeners expect to find in your recently released book, Who's the Bastard in Black?
Well, people have summed it up as the most honest account of refereeing. There have been books in the past that have more or less been a day in a life of a referee and an insight. I've told the truth from the beginning of being a football fan in England in the 70s, when obviously we had the problems with football violence on the terraces, and I grew up through that era supporting my hometown club, Middlesbrough. And then the story of getting through the local leagues, some of the humour, some of the events that went on in the pub leagues and the Sunday junior leagues, going through non-league football right the way to the top, and it gives some very honest accounts of my dealings with the stars in the game and my fallouts with managers such as Sir Alex Ferguson. Obviously there's a big chapter on the FA Cup final, but intermingled through stories about my career is also things that have gone on in my life, personal tragedies, following of the football team, and everything that's gone towards, you know, being the story of my life, really. And then when the football career finishes, a little insight into what I'm doing now with the after-dinner work and the media work, some of my falls out with officialdom even since I finished refereeing, and, you know, some very frank views on what I think is wrong with the professional game and certainly refereeing in England.
What was it like growing up in the 70s and going to see Middlesbrough play at Ayresome Park? What are some of your fondest memories of that time?
I think it was just running with the lads, really, because in those days, like the youngsters today, they've got the internet, they've got the computers, they've got their Game Boys and everything else to keep them amused. Way back in the 70s in England, in a working class town, you grew up, if you liked football, and most people did, it was natural to go and support your team. And obviously it wasn't just going to the home games in England. You know, the longest journey you're ever going to have anywhere is probably about 300 miles, and a lot of them a lot less than that. So come a Saturday, you were on a coach with the lads going away watching football, and it was good fun. In those days, there wasn't obviously the security that they have in football grounds nowadays, the all-seater stadiums. It was really turning up in a strange town, hundreds and hundreds of you, and supporting your team. And I've got very, very fond memories of those days of being a football fan in that era.
So I understand that there were a lot of stories written for the book that ended up on the cutting room floor due to space constraints. Are there any particular stories that jumped to mind that would interest the listeners that were kind of left on the floor?
Well, I suppose it's like when you make a film, there's always that. We had a remit to do about 90,000 words, and we ended up with about 110,000 words. And, you know, I think the publishers, with a lot of experience, wanted the book to be snappy, and as it was the first time I'd ever been involved in putting together a book, there was probably bits that didn't quite have the tact, the diplomacy and flow with the rest of it. But I feel sure now, having read it, the best bits are in the book, and that has been, producing the number of sales. The hardback did very well, and since the paperback's come out, that's continued to sell very well. So I've got to bow my head, my head, and show my appreciation to those who guided me, because they know what makes a good book. I've still got the other bit somewhere, so whether there's another book in me, I don't know. Perhaps not on this subject, but the bits that are in there hopefully are the best bits.
Now, I have a question from one of our listeners. His name is, his nickname is Wanderer Abroad. He's a Wickham Wanderer supporter in America. And he wanted to ask, what made you want to become a referee, and did anyone inspire you?
Well, the basic answer to that was because I was crap at being a footballer. The best thing to do in any form of sport is to actually participate. And when I say I was crap, I probably have played non-league and local league football, but not good enough to get into the professional game. And what inspired me, it's like most things in life, sometimes you actually fall into it by accident. I knew this guy locally who was involved with the County Football Association, and he encouraged me to just take the ref's course. And I took the course and started doing the odd game, and then it just took over. To actually keep fit and be out there and doing something on a weekend was good. You obviously got a little bit of money as well, which helped. But then once you get involved into the professional game, to actually be out there on the pitch with the stars was something that was absolutely fantastic. So if I'd have been any good at sport, then hopefully I'd have been on my way to America now on a deal somewhat similar to what David Beckham's got. But unfortunately, I didn't have the talent. Some people might say I didn't have the talent as a referee, but I thoroughly enjoyed that experience. And, I would actually recommend it to anybody. If you're not actually good enough to get to the very top playing the game, then why not have a bash at, being a referee? Yeah, you've got to have a thick skin. You're never going to be popular, but there is the great buzz of actually being involved in a game that we all love.
So what's your current belief or kind of standing or opinion on the current state of officialdom, kind of just refereeing? There's been a lot of controversy of late, but how do you think the standard is right now?
I think the standard perhaps could be better, but it's too glib just to make that comment. I think the game has changed. It's changed greatly in the 3 years I've been out of it. Because of the money in the game. Now, I don't think football at the highest level is a sport anymore. It's a multi-million pound business. And referees are making decisions that are obviously potentially costing clubs millions of pounds. Coupled with the interest in the game, we've now got much more media coverage. And, every decision in football is dissected and looked at. Radio shows like my own and television punditry, there's a full-time profession with the newspapers and the media on the back of a game of football. And many a year ago, a decision would just be made and that was the end of it. But now, every decision from a throw-in, free kick, penalty kick, goal is looked at with a very, very critical view of the referee's decision. It puts a lot more pressure on officials, that's for sure. I think there's so much money in the game now that the big clubs are having a very unhealthy influence on what goes on. The appointment of referees and the management of referees should be something that is totally, aside from the running of the clubs. Unfortunately, in England, in the professional game, the clubs have far too much say and the bigger clubs are more powerful. We're finding situations where a match referee might make a big decision in a game featuring Chelsea, Manchester United, Arsenal, Liverpool. The clubs are not happy, and then lo and behold, that referee doesn't get any big games for weeks. So, that to me is all wrong. The game is a fantastic spectacle, but it's unfortunate that every decision of the referee is being criticised. And at the end of the day, people seem to forget that in the course of 90 minutes, there will be big decisions. But, players make mistakes. The game is about human error. The other thing that's making it very, very difficult for referees now is that more and more players are play-acting and cheating. We're seeing diving. We've always had diving in the game. And in the English game, in the past, it's been easy to blame foreign players. It's not only the foreign players, but certainly the foreign influence, the temperament that some players have brought into the Premiership. We see the likes of Ronaldo, who is to watch, an absolute joy to watch when he's doing what he does best, play football. But the other side of his game, and he's not the only one, is that, you know, his diving and his antics to win penalties, you know, they're a cancer in the game, and they're spoiling the game, but unfortunately they're making it more and more difficult for referees. Referees, you know, get a split second to make a decision, and the cry in this country and across the world has been for video technology. And, you know, my belief has always been that the game of football is not a stop-start game. It's continuous. The ball flows from one end to another. And it would actually kill the game if we were stopping and looking at videos and dissecting it. The game of football would perhaps become somewhat similar to American football. And instead of being a 90-minute sport, it would perhaps be a 3 or 4 hour sport. And, you know, my belief, and it's one that's shared with many other people, is that that sort of thing would kill the game of football.
Do you think there's a way, though, to kind of do retroactive punishment? I mean, for blatant cheating after matches and having maybe a committee or someone reviewing that and then awarding or deducting points or awarding yellow cards or yellow cards after the fact?
I agree with that 100%. I think we should have a Monday morning review of games. And, you know, you're not going to change results. You're not going to give goals that should have been and give penalties that should have been, etc. But on a Monday morning, there should be a review. You've got to look at the players who are cheating. You've got to ridicule them. You've got to take action against them. The big problem is what course of action should be taken, because fining a player or fining a club, one of the top clubs, you know, it's just pennies. It just makes no difference. You know, fining Chelsea £10,000, Manchester United £5,000, it's a joke. It would have no effect whatsoever. Finding a player £10,000 or £5,000, again, with professional footballers on anything from £50,000 to £100,000 a week, the top stars in the Premiership, then taking £5,000 off them would be like, you know, taking some loose change out of your pocket or my pocket. So, you know, the points deduction is something that I think has got to be a threat, something that does hit a club and jeopardise their chances of making progress. Whether it'll ever happen, you know, I do have my doubts, because the lawmakers make a lot of noise about, you know, this is bad for the image of the game, but rarely do we see them actually take some action. And, you know, what we should have is the fans lobbying. I know there is a website now, I think it's www.ridthegame.com, where fans are being asked to register their vote, and they're trying to get a million people signed up with a petition to lobby, you know, UEFA and FIFA, and say, look, we the football fans are sick and tired of this cheating and diving, and we want and expect you to do something about it.
Definitely something to check out, definitely that website there, yeah, a good idea. What are your thoughts about UEFA President Michel Platini, his recommendation to add two officials to the pitch so that you have kind of one standing in each of the penalty areas assisting with penalty decisions and offside decisions?
Wonderful, but where are you going to get the officials from? There is a shortage of match officials in the UK, you know, there's 30,000 qualified referees, around that figure, but we're talking about, you know, games that go on a Saturday and a Sunday, junior sides, sides from pubs and clubs. If these officials are all going to be moved up, assuming, of course, they have the experience and the ability to officiate at the highest level, then you're going to have games of football not taking part at a lower football because there just isn't enough officials. There's some weird and wonderful ideas come out of UEFA and FIFA. We listen to them during the course of the World Cup. Knee-jerk reactions where people who should know better open their mouths, they spout out without ideas, without thinking the full consequences. And having more officials on the fit pitch, one argument would be, well, there's more chance of seeing things. The second argument would be, you know, there's a lack of consistency there, because within the course of a game of football, you could have one referee saying one thing to a player and another referee saying another. The argument to that would obviously be to have them mic'd up. But, you know, does the game of football really require this? Perhaps the root of the problems lies a little bit closer to home. And if the lawmakers were to support their referees, give them backing, and then support them after a game, not only verbally, but perhaps by taking actions, as we've just said, against the people that are cheating, the comments that managers make about referees, Because it's quite easy after a game to slag off a referee. You very rarely do you hear a manager coming on air saying, well, I picked the wrong team today, my tactics were bad, I signed the wrong players, my players didn't perform. No, it's easy to jump on the bandwagon and just blame the referee. So perhaps if sanctions were brought in to clean up the game and to improve the discipline on the pitch, then referees wouldn't be in the highlight as much as they are.
How would you rate the development of referees in England in terms of, say, a young teenager, say, that wants to be a referee and wants to go through the system and make his way up to go through the proper channels and get to the top? I mean, is it that system in place? Is it a good system?
Yeah, I think the infrastructure now is even better. There is a lot of help given to teenagers who wish to start refereeing, because if you really want to get to the top and get to be a World Cup referee or a Champions League referee, then you're not going to do it by starting refereeing at 30. You know, you need to be starting refereeing in your teens or very early 20s to get onto the ladder. And there are development groups, and there is, you know, a lot of education, a lot of training, and a lot of support to get people up there. Problems start when you get nearer the top because, you know, referees are assessed, and referees at times are doing too much to try and keep the assessor happy to get good marks than actually being firm and doing the job properly on a football pitch. They're looking at the idiosyncrasies of an assessor and saying, oh, well, if I do this, he'll be happy. And sometimes, you know, as a referee, the simple fact when you start refereeing, you're never ever going to keep people happy all of the time. You've just got to go out there and do the job. And then hopefully, you know, cream will rise to the top. But there are a lot of young referees in England, and some of them are coming through into the system now at the highest level. People like Howard Webb, Mark Clattenburg, Martin Atkinson, who are a younger breed of referee. They're getting a lot of big games very early in their career, and this has been forced upon them in a way because there has been mismanagement of the referees, in my opinion, in the Premier League and at the highest level. And, you know, they haven't brought people through quickly enough to replace the sort of experienced officials that have retired from the game in the last 4 or 5 years. But there are good referees out there. It's a case of really feeding them through, letting them get the experience so they can mature. But what happens in England, as soon as you have a bad game, you're absolutely castigated, pushed to one side and forgotten about for a while, until you can be put back into the limelight and get any more big games. And it seems as if upsetting a club is the be-all and end-all. And if you've upset one of the big boys, then that can be detrimental for your immediate progression of your career, which isn't helpful, because a referee is going to make decisions in a game. He's never going to keep both sides happy. So, you know, it's a thankless task in that respect. And the big games that we all want to referee, you know, you're looking at Manchester United versus Arsenal, Chelsea versus Arsenal, Chelsea versus Manchester United, those sort of games where there's so much at stake, it's very often at the end of the game that the referee's the one being singled out as the excuse when the result hasn't gone the way of both teams.
That's the thing I think about being a referee too. Is, I mean, you might be playing at Old Trafford and you have 70,000 fans, both home and away, and they're all hurling their abuse or hatred towards one person on the pitch, which may or may not be the reason for the team's loss or whatever the situation is. Stepping into the shoes of a referee, I mean, how does it feel to have that many people kind of just hurling abuse at you during a match?
Well, not forgetting, by the time you get to referee a game at Old Trafford, you've probably been refereeing through local leagues and the non-league pyramid in England. You could have been refereeing for an absolute minimum of 10 to 15 years. So by the time you get there, you've got a certain amount of experience. And before you get to Old Trafford, you've refereed in the Football League at crowds where you can get anything from 2,000 to 15,000. So there's a natural progression. You just don't get thrown into 76,000 people at Old Trafford. But the first time you do referee at a big, big ground like that, obviously it is fairly intimidating. But with experience, it just becomes part and parcel of the job. But the bottom line is that if a referee at any level is going to be intimidated by the home fans, then we've got a whole problem, because, you know, the referee has got to be impartial. If it's a penalty against Manchester United at Old Trafford, then it's a penalty. You've got to give it. It's not a case of thinking, oh, there's 72,000 home fans and 4,000 away fans there. You know, the whole honesty, the whole integrity, the whole meaning of being an impartial referee goes out of the window if you're swayed. Now, who knows subconsciously what goes on in the mind of an official when the bulk of the crowd are baying for his blood? But I can only speak from personal experience, and when you're out there, the noise and the songs that are not too complimentary about referees are merely a noise, and that really just heightens your concentration to go out there and do the job properly.
Now, you mentioned last night too, kind of following Hartlepool and Darlington there in the northeast, but there was another big match, and that was in France with Lille playing Manchester United in the Champions League. And first question is, did you get a chance to see some of the footage of some of the controversial decisions in the game?
I most certainly did. Working for the media now, you've got to have your finger on the pulse. And I'd taped some of the game, and when I came in last night, obviously watched it. And I've just been doing some articles this morning for the, for my weblog and for the local newspapers that I write for. I mean, anarchy on a football pitch that we saw last night was absolutely unbelievable. At the end of the day, the referee has had two major decisions to make in that game. And in my humble opinion, he got them both right. The goal that he chalked off for Lille was a clear push by the forward. He did well to spot that, and to me it was 100% correct. The second decision is obviously the Manchester United goal, which turns out to be the winning goal. And, you know, people scream and say, oh, you know, ex-players should be referees. Well, if they want to be referees, they're going to have to learn the laws of the game. And we've been over and over this subject. A free kick to the attacking side. The referee's got to get the wall back. But if he sees the opportunity for the attacking team to get an advantage, he says, you know, do you want to take the free kick quickly? He's clearly done this to Manchester United because you see him moving away. He doesn't have to blow the whistle, which is another misconception. He's purely, he clearly has to signal, get on with it. They've took the free kick, the ball's in the back of the net, and they feel aggrieved. But the actions of their coach calling them off the pitch, I don't think we've heard the last of this, and certainly the gentleman you mentioned earlier, Michel Platini, who is the new president of UEFA, this is a chance for him really to clamp down. Big problem, though, it's a French team, so it'll be very, very interesting to see exactly what he does. But, you know, action should be taken against the club and the individual that's called them off. I tell you something, if that had been a referee doing something really that was found to be wrong, that referee would be out. That referee wouldn't be getting any top games for a long, long time, if at all, again in the future. It'd be interesting to see what happens to that coach, because the coach, it's the spirit of the game and everything else. My personal opinion is they should hammer him. He should be given a lengthy ban and a substantial fine, because at the end of the day, whether the fans agree with it or whatever, the referee's decision is final. And, you know, to suggest that we're going to walk off like spoiled children, throwing your toys out of the pram, spitting your dummy out, I think that is a new low for the image of professional football.
Yeah, and I think the Dutch referee, Eric Bramhard, did a fantastic job in a hostile situation and definitely was very firm with his decisions.
Well, it touches, Chris, on what we were just talking about the impartiality of it, you know. Mm-hmm. If you're going to say that referees are going to succumb to the pressure of the crowd and the intimidating atmosphere, then it would have been very easy last night to give the goal to Lille and to chalk off the Manchester United goal, but he didn't. He refereed the game properly, and, you know, that does actually warm my heart when I think, well, you see an official who does things, and, you know, then the people who turn around and say, oh, well, it was the home team, and it was this, and it was that. You can put last night as a perfect example of impartial refereeing, strong refereeing, and more importantly, correct refereeing.
Absolutely. So another question from one of our listeners, this is BC John in Jacksonville, Florida, and he wants to ask, what was it like to have your last game as a referee to be a FA Cup final?
Absolutely fantastic. I mean, I sort of did break a little bit of a trend, because normally the FA Cup referee, it's an honour that only you get once in your career, and obviously not many have achieved that. It usually goes to someone who's currently on the international list. And it was actually turned out to be the last game of my career, and something again that they would never ever do, because, you know, if there's anything happens in that, you know, the publicity, it's not like from a referee's point of view, you can come back the following season, like Graham Paul did after the World Cup, and try and rebuild his career. If it goes really wrong in that game, it's the last game of your career, you'll always be remembered for it. But I'd refereed on a fair few grounds and done most of the big derby games and enjoyed the tremendous atmosphere of those big games. But nothing could prepare you for the atmosphere in that ground. I mean, the new Wembley is really going to have to go some to get an atmosphere as good as the Millennium Stadium. The most important thing of the day for me was that at the end of the game, people were saying, oh, well, it wasn't the best cup final, a bit one-sided and everything. But the great thing from my point of view was that there was no controversy. There was a shout for a penalty I didn't give, and I did award a penalty, which, you know, the experts for once hopefully got it right and said that I got it right. We had one yellow card in the game, and as I say, the most important thing at the end of the game of football, nobody was really talking about the referee, they were talking about the game, and let's be honest, that's how it should be all the time. People don't pay a lot of money to go and watch a referee, they go to watch the footballers, but far too often, whether it be through a decision or just through media or manager reaction, it's the referee we're talking about at the end of the game. So perhaps I got out of jail, but it was certainly a fitting climax to my career, and I was able to park that and move on, because quite often in life people go on about the good old days and what was it like and everything like that. I obviously believe as one door closes, you've got to open another one and move on, but certainly I loved every minute of my 25-year refereeing career, mistakes and all. You know, slaughterings in the press, criticisms from managers, all part and parcel. And as I said earlier, you know, would recommend anyone having a go at it.
Okay. And another question from Wanderer Abroad. He says he wants to know, what was the worst thing said to you by a manager or a player?
I think I'd have to write another book and it'd be X-rated. I mean, what you've got to do, I mean, and in the book, actually, I don't pull any punches. There's things you can't say on air, but you can actually put into a book. And, you know, it's interesting recently that referee Phil Dowd was accused of swearing at a player. Well, I had a conversation after the Hartlepool game last night with my old mate and adversary, Paul Ince, and we had a good little laugh about that, because in the heat of the battle, things are said. And, you know, that sums it up. If a player just cusses at you or swears in the context of asking you a question, and I often used to find giving them some back worked for me. But, you know, it's one thing in the heat of the moment. When you see a prolonged, vicious verbal attack, you know, then the referees have got to be big enough and strong enough to do something about it. But most of the things said to me were perhaps X-rated, but there's a humorous side to it as well. But, you know, you never got anything that was... I don't think I was ever deeply offended by anything that was said to me. And if I had been, they'd have got it back with interest, I can assure you.
Now, you mentioned Phil Dowd, and it's interesting too, because I think with being mic'd up during a game, I mean, definitely it improves the communication between the referee and the assistant referees. But one of the other things I noticed from the Wigan-Arsenal match was that the mics were being used by Phil Dowd to talk to the fourth official who was standing next to Paul Jewell to kind of basically kind of express kind of what Phil Dowd's thoughts were on, I guess, Paul Jewell probably on the touchline, kind of what he was saying. In some ways, do you see kind of some negative effects of having referees mic'd up, and then, I mean, managers having to be able to have more access to talk to perhaps the referee on the pitch?
I think, you know, we've seen in other sports, rugby being a perfect example of where what the referee is saying to the players is there for the fans and everybody else, the TV crowd, you know, audience to listen to. And it hasn't been detrimental. In fact, people say that in rugby, it's actually been helpful in hearing why a referee has given a decision. Football has a totally different mentality. Certainly the language can be blue out there. So, you know, maybe you're going to need an on-off switch on your headset, and maybe games televised have got to be on after the watershed on an evening. But I'm not so sure that there is the necessity for that. Because, you know, at the end of the day in football, fans and managers are not really interested why a referee has given a decision. If it goes in their favour, they'll accept it. If it goes against them, they want to cuss and they want to complain. And perhaps chances for referees to be involved much more on the media side following games, making explanation then. And sometimes you've got to hold up your hands and say, I got it wrong. Just like a player has to say, I missed a penalty, or I let a soft shot go in between my legs. You know, the honesty time is afterwards, but in the heat and the emotion of the game, a referee really has enough to concentrate on without entering into too much dialogue with people while the game's going on. The argument is it might clean up the language. Well, we'd have to see. I think there'd be more bleeps. There'd be some, perhaps a full-time job for me now would be to sit in a studio pressing the bleep button every time an expletive was used. I don't think there's a lot wrong with football that can't be, you know, the game of football has been there before we were born. It'll certainly be there after we're no longer around. The things within the game need tidying up. And it's easy all the time to blame the referee. I think the major ills of the game, referees are human, they'll always make mistakes. They're never going to be perfect, whether you're Kalina, Graham Paul, or whoever you are. You're never going to get everything right. But the major ills in the game come from, you know, some of the antics of the players. And as I say, the cheating and the diving, etc. They're things that the authorities could clamp out, I believe, quite easily, but with stern punishment. Then the game's going to be made a lot easier for a referee, and, you know, then perhaps the criticism won't be as great as it is at the moment.
Sure. Okay, just a few more questions to go, and this one is from a gentleman by the name of Twigster, is his nickname, and he asks, why did you always have it in for Leeds when you were refereeing?
You see, this is the wonderful problem, Twigster, that fans, as now I go around the country on the after-dinner circuit, they say, oh, you never liked Man United, you never liked Chelsea, you never liked Leeds. And they're quite right, I didn't. They weren't my team, I wasn't supporting them. I was there to referee a game of football. And the perception may be that, you know, I put Sir Alex Ferguson in the stand at one game, so that makes me an anti-Manchester United. I put two Leeds United players, sent them off, Boyer and Mills, and from that moment onward, all the Leeds United fans, he doesn't like us. Well, I think every fan of every club in the country would look at one decision, one yellow card or one red card, and make a good case for you not liking a team. It wasn't a case of not liking a team, you just had to do what you saw on the day. And the fans' perception would always be very much coloured by the fact that if you made a decision against their team, you didn't like them, you were biased, you'd got it in for them. I can assure them, I can assure anyone out there, I was never biased in any way, shape or form for any team in my life. Made a lot of mistakes, got to hold my hands up to that. I think I made a lot more correct decisions than I made wrong decisions. For the ones that I did get wrong, and I remember, funnily enough, this gentleman's talking about a Leeds United game. I refereed Leeds United away to Manchester United and showed Alan Smith a yellow card, which at the time wasn't too difficult. But later on, when I got home and watched the video of the game, saw the challenge I'd given a yellow card for, and contacted the FA and said, look, I've had a look at it now. I can't undo the yellow card I showed on Saturday. But having watched it, I think I was harsh and it shouldn't have been a yellow card. And the FA at that time actually rescinded that decision. So, you know, it's not a case of who you like and who you don't like. It's trying to get it right.
Okay. And then the next question is from Graham Bell. And it's actually a two-part question. The first part of the question is, have you ever had your stopwatches go off on you and stop working? And the second part is, do you have like a funniest falling over moment during a match?
Yeah, and it's funny how people find it funny when a referee falls over. Biggest roar of the day. With regard to the stopwatch, then yeah, I mean, stopwatches that are run by batteries, sooner or later the battery's going to go pop and it doesn't give you any advance warning. And that's why referees do actually carry two watches. And yes, I have had a battery go on me and you go, oh my God, but then you've got another watch to look at. And what I tended to do was have one watch running, and the other watch I used as a stopwatch, so I was stopping and starting it. So if you had a scenario where, you know, one watch is showing you've played 45 minutes, the other watch is showing you've got 2 minutes left to play, that coupled with the fact that you've got two assistant referees and a fourth official have all got two watches, then there is a fair amount of, cover in case a watch goes. But funnily enough, on that particular subject, and you talk about technology and things, that's the one thing I think football could take a leaf out of other sports books and have an independent timekeeper, even linked perhaps to a stadium clock where somebody in the stand, when the ball goes out of play, when the referee's talking to a player, when there's an injury or whatever, there is somebody independent who can stop start a clock so that everybody knows. Then there's never an argument as, you know, why is the referee played 5 minutes or 4 minutes? it's actually done in advance, and I think that's something that would improve the situation. With regard to falling over, probably the highlight in many people's eyes of my career wasn't actually a falling over. It was an incident that happened in a Liverpool versus Bradford City game in the Premiership, when a player had given a penalty to Liverpool and a player just lashed the ball in sheer frustration, and it knocked me in the back of the head, nearly knocking me over. And it's one of those that appears in, you know, the Christmas videos of humorous incidents, etc. And for some bizarre reason, there are so many football fans out there who take great pleasure in seeing me nearly get knocked over with a football, but that's the problem of being a referee.
Sure. So the last question, Jeff, I have is, what's the most interesting fact about you that the listeners would be surprised to hear?
Oh, dear me. Whether we're talking football-wise, or I'm no different to any normal guy out there that's watching the sport. I'm a working-class lad in a working-class town in the north of England. Loved watching football, still do. Loved playing it, but I wasn't good enough. Loved refereeing it. Away from that, you know, I'm just no different to anybody else trying to make a living. Love the media work now, love the entertainment industry. I don't think there's anything different from me to anybody else out there. As a referee, you've got to keep cool and calm under pressure. As a general guy in life, you know, live your life, enjoy every day as if it's your last, because, you know, sooner or later one of them will be. But I'm nothing special. I've got had some skills, and a lot of things I'm not very good at, and you try and hone in on the ones that you are good at and enjoy life to the full. Other than that, well, read the book. You know, you might find something interesting in there, but I don't think I'm any different to anybody else out in this world.
Okay, well, Jeff Winter, the author of Who's the Bastard in Black, we'll add some links to the website so people can go ahead and check that book out. Jeff, it's been a pleasure speaking with you this morning, and thank you so much for your time in doing the interview.
Not a problem.
Jeff Winter's publishers were kind enough to send us a copy of his book to give away as a prize on this show. So here's how you can win a copy of Who's the Bastard in the Black. All you have to do is visit epltalk.com, click on the podcast link, and then click on the listener survey on the right side of the page. Then just complete the survey and email me at thegaffer@epltalk.com, and then tell me what the question number 23 asked. And if you've already filled out the listener survey in the past, no need to do anything. You're automatically entered into the competition, and we'll go ahead and announce the winner of the book in next week's episode. One more thing before we continue with this episode is I do want to point out that we have a great new feature on the Premiership Community site, which is linked to from epltalk.com, and that is a daily soccer news digest. This is put together faithfully by one of our faithful readers / listeners, and that's BC John from Jacksonville, Florida. And each morning what he does is compiles a very comprehensive report of some of the top stories from the world of Premiership football, and has links to several different news sources throughout the UK and throughout the world, so that when you get up each morning, you can just log on to the Premiership Community site and read his blog postings and get a daily digest of news in bite-sized information. He's done all the work for you. So thank you so much to BC John for doing that. BC is also the host of the EPL Talk Chat. Each weekend, this past weekend for the Calling Cup, had the biggest attendance yet. I think there was over 50 people in the chat room. And we hope for a big turnout this weekend too, with the Liverpool against Manchester United and all the other top matches. So check it out at epltalk.com, both the EPL Talk Chat and the Daily Soccer News Digest from the Premiership Community. Next up is a conversation with our guest, Brian Koski, making his first appearance on the EPL Talk podcast. During the conversation, you'll hear quite a few interesting topics, such as an American player who is at loan at Leeds United, the resurgence of Sunderland, what's going wrong at Manchester City, and the Championship sides in the best position to get promoted to the Premiership this May. Well, it is a pleasure to have on the air with us Brian Kosky. How are you doing this evening, Brian?
Greetings. I'm above average. How are you, Chris?
Very well. Very, very well. Getting ready for a good week of football. So I wanted to talk to you, Brian, about several different topics, many of which are Championship League related. And, of course, a lot of the action and a lot of the debate is on the Premiership. But in some ways, the Championship League is just as entertaining and much closer in terms of the teams. Any topics you'd like to kind of jump in and talk about there, Brian?
Well, I think to start things off, the promotion and relegation battles are very compelling once again this year in the Coca-Cola League Championship, and I think that's one of the great assets of the league is there's often a mad scramble to get into that top six, for instance, and we're seeing that once again this season.
Yeah, it's really tight there. I was looking at also at the Premiership, and the Premiership, for example, from the bottom place team to the top place team, the point difference is 48 points. In the Championship League, there's more teams, there's 24 teams, but from the bottom to the top, there's a point difference of about 33 points. So obviously quite a difference even between the Premiership and the Champions League. In terms of looking at the table, I know it's still early, but any teams you kind of think that have a good chance of being promoted and vice versa getting relegated?
Yeah, I think three clubs really stand out for me as far as in prime position to be promoted. West Brom and Derby and Birmingham are near the top of the table. I actually really like Derby and Birmingham to advance. They're on strong form, Chris, and they have games in hand as well. In addition to that, out of that mad scramble that they're trying to get into the top six, I fancy Sunderland's chances to win a playoff because it's really remarkable their run of form after their horrific start to the season, where I believe they lost outright their first four or five matches, including a Carling Cup match, and were buried at the bottom of the table. They've climbed and climbed all the way up, well comfortably in the top six at this moment, and it pains me as a City supporter to compliment Roy Keane, but he's really done a tremendous job there.
Yeah, it makes you wonder too. I mean, what would have happened if Mick McCarthy was still in charge? I mean, would there be in the relegation threatened zone right now, or would they be a little bit better off? But yeah, but Roy Keane, without a doubt, has done a fantastic job, and understandably so. As a Manchester City supporter, I can understand the well, especially after the Alpha Inga Haaland foul many years ago. So it's definitely bad memories there.
Yes, the wounds haven't healed, Chris.
And I'm sure for Alfinger Haaland, too, I'm sure they haven't healed either. But so what about looking at some of the other teams, too? What about Coventry? They had a recent change at the top there.
Yes, Ian Dowie, recent news, is going to take the manager post out up in Coventry. Now, rumor has it he was offered the Hull job not too long ago, which he turned down. And he is replacing the caretaker manager, Adrian Heath, who replaced Mickey Adams, who was sacked in January. So I thought that this was an interesting move, Chris. I think he's a good manager. He didn't quite get enough time at Charlton, in my opinion. It was rightfully scandalous, that, you know, the reasoning why he left Palace and then ended up at Charlton. But I think he's a good manager, and this would be a good fit for him.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because, I mean, with the league being so tight, I mean, he is in a spot where there isn't that much room for failure, really. I mean, if they do lose some more matches, there's a good chance they might fall deep into the relegation zone. So at the beginning of the season, of course, with Charlton, he had a tough time, and hopefully with Coventry, he'll be able to kind of pull them out of that danger area. So in terms of looking at some of the other teams, too, two teams of interest, I think, are the ones in the FA Cup, and Plymouth and West Bromwich Albion.
Right. Currently, out of the 11 clubs still in the FA Cup, there are two from the Championship, who you mentioned. And, you know, what was really interesting is the recent draw occurred for the quarterfinals, and arguably the two worst teams left in the competition, who were guaranteed to be in the quarterfinals, drew each other. So I'm talking about Watford and Plymouth. I believe that matches at Plymouth Argyle. So a tremendous news for Ian Holloway and company. They have a very reasonable chance of getting to the semifinals. West Brom, a lot more work to do on their end, and a bad draw in the quarters.
And actually Plymouth against Watford should be a pretty interesting match to watch, really, to see kind of what the difference is between a bottom of the table Premiership side versus kind of a mid-table Championship league side, to see if there's much of a disparity between the two, or if it's pretty close in style of play, perhaps.
Absolutely. And, you know, Watford always has the challenge of, you know, should we go forward in the FA Cup, given that we're fighting for our lives in the Premiership? I tend to think that clubs are overly conservative in that vein. Sheffield United and Reading come right to mind. I don't understand why there's not starting first team players in the FA Cup. But anyways, it'll be interesting to see if Watford starts their best players in that match, if they're still fighting for their lives in the Premiership, which they probably will be.
So speaking of Watford, I mean, the interesting thing I think of is that there's quite a few Americans that are stuck in the relegation threatened area of the Premiership. And looking at Watford, of course, Jonathan Spector, I believe, at West Ham United, he's in a little bit of trouble there too. But looking at the Championship League, Leeds United is another side that comes to mind, and I understand there was an interesting loan signing recently made from Wolves.
Yes, Jamal Johnson, Chris, who I found to be a promising striker. He's bounced around a lot. He was originally with Blackburn, I believe, and had loan spells with Preston and Darlington. He has been playing with Wolves this season. I believe he has had 24 appearances and three goals, but Wolves have signed a couple other strikers in the January transfer window, Stephen Ward being one of them, and they're in that mix of, I would say, the top 10 clubs in the Championship who legitimately have a chance at promotion or a playoff berth, at least. And Jamal Johnson is not finding regular playing time after these transfer signings at Wolves, so he is now going on loan to Leeds for 1 month in order to help them survive at the bottom of the table.
And Jamal will be joining Eddie Lewis there already at Leeds, another American. I did some research on Jamal, and it was interesting too, because he lived, he basically grew up in New Jersey until the age of about five. Then his parents decided to move to Macclesfield, of all places.
Glamorous.
I know, in England. And so he's been growing up in England since then. And I believe he played for Manchester United in the kind of the youth system. And then, as you mentioned, went to Blackburn and then had some tryouts with, I think, loan signings with Darlington, etc., and now on to Leeds. But another American that's stuck in kind of a relegation threatened team, and it'll be interesting to see if he'll be able to kind of get some goals for Leeds and pull them out of the trouble there.
Yes, and he'll be the only person in the locker room, perhaps, that isn't eligible to be accused as the individual who passed the starting lineup to Palace, which is still an open issue, I believe. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, speaking of locker room, too, there was an incident recently involving some players in the Championship League. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. Very, very entertaining league, the Championship, Chris, as well as the Premiership. A great soap opera. And once again, recently, some controversy. The Stoke City-Luton Town match, a couple individuals got sent off, Ricardo Fuller, a striker for Stoke, as well as Sol Davis, a Luton defender. And right around 4:30 p.m. local time, in the middle of the second half, turns out the two got into a scrap, I believe, underneath the grandstand in the locker room areas. And this was an all-out brawl between the two, and they had to be separated, required stitches. And the authorities are investigating, Chris. So never a dull moment in the Championships, even Luton at Stoke.
It's interesting, too, that the police statement says, at 4:30 p.m., police attended the Britannia Stadium following reports of two men being involved in an incident. I mean, come on, I mean, to say it's a fight or, I mean, it's an incident, which who knows? I mean, it's just, but yeah, it is interesting, too. I mean, there's a lot of things that go on in the Championship that sometimes are a little bit well, more scandalous, perhaps, than the Premiership in terms of some of the action behind the scenes there.
Yeah, the QPR kickboxing showdown versus the Chinese squad comes to mind as well.
That's right. And then, of course, you had Luton Town recently, too, with Mike Newell, unfortunately, saying some really terrible things about a female linesman, but never short of a story. But speaking of the championship just in general, too, I understand that it's a topic near and dearer to your heart and may parlay its way into some future podcasts, perhaps.
Yes, I'm planning on starting a new podcast this summer, which solely focuses on the Coca-Cola League Championship. And I'm happy to, you know, say that this show is going to be affiliated possibly with EPL Talk. I appreciate your encouragement and support, Chris. And, you know, basically, as I said, I'm a football junkie. I love the Premiership, and I'm a Man City supporter. But I'm interested in all things in football, and it's really been shocking to me, Chris, that I can't go out to iTunes, for example, and just download a show that just focuses on the championship. There are many shows focusing on the Premiership, but I feel that there's a huge void with this league, which, if you think about it, gets dramatically overshadowed for understandable reasons by the EPL. But in reality, in my opinion, this is the second most important English-speaking professional football league on the planet by far. You know, it's the sixth richest professional league in Europe per Deloitte, and it's come in certain years, 2004 being one of them, as the fourth highest league in attendance in Europe. So obviously some very strong connections between the championship and the premiership, and tremendous support. And I just think about, you know, the West Ham fan next season, or the Palace or the Sunderland fans who have moved away from England. Where do these people turn, Chris, if they want to follow the league? They have very little options.
Yeah, especially in America, too. I mean, there is Satanta Sports, which does show some of the matches, usually about one or two a week, and then they have the highlights package. But in some ways, too, I mean, the fans of the teams in the championship are very passionate, and in some ways probably more passionate than those in the premiership in terms of these are diehard fans that have stuck with teams like Leeds United or Stoke or Wolves or Birmingham, etc. A lot of history. And you're absolutely right, Brian. It's something that doesn't really get that much exposure in the States because the premiership overshadows everything with all the TV exposure. And it's definitely something that I know you, Brian, that's, as a Manchester City fan, it'll be definitely interesting to hear your thoughts in the future on the podcast. And I think in many ways, too, it's something that, I mean, a lot of us know you from your guest spots on World Soccer Daily and also on A Game of Two Halves. So it's definitely interesting and definitely something we're looking forward to hearing more about.
Great. I'm looking forward to it as well, Chris. And I might have mentioned that I plan on starting this summer. It'll be a weekly show, and there'll be a cast of characters as guests. It's going to have a very British feel to it, Chris. You know, I know some people out there probably don't want to hear a Yank speak all the time on their league in England. So it's going to be me and a cast of characters from England, and I'm looking forward to also being affiliated with EPL Talk, and once again, appreciate your support.
Yep, no problem. We'd love to get more football fans into football and get them to understand the championship more and get them a greater appreciation for that league, which it definitely deserves. So speaking of your team, Brian, Manchester City, it's been a tough season so far, but I think the one glimmer of shining hope is the FA Cup. And what are your thoughts on maybe City's chances of progressing through to perhaps the semi-finals?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic, actually, about our chances, which is an oxymoron for a City supporter, perhaps. But, you know, we didn't get the best draw, Arsenal or Blackburn, in the quarters. But one reason for optimism is that both clubs are going to have congested fixtures in the upcoming weeks. Both of those clubs are in Europe, and Arsenal in particular has the Carling Cup finals. So I think we've got a puncher's chance, if you will. This is going to be a road fixture, but the victory over Preston was encouraging, and you know, Arsenal's form at home has not been stellar as of late, so I think we have a chance, Chris, primarily because, as I said, our opponents are really going to face some serious fixture congestion in coming weeks.
Yeah, and for me too. I mean, definitely survival is, I think, priority number one for City, just to make sure that they stay above the relegation area and stay in the Premiership. But to me, though, the FA Cup is probably the only chance right now to have any chance of doing something really great this season, perhaps maybe if they do play, say, an Arsenal or Blackburn, pulling off maybe a shock result there, or at least a draw, and then going back to the City of Manchester Stadium. So in terms of the Premiership, though, I mean, kind of what's the situation right now with Manchester City? I mean, do you think that they have a good chance of staying up?
I do. I'm gutted this is even a question, though, after the nice holiday run we've had. We've had some woeful Premiership results at home, in particular, as of late. Reading and Blackburn come to mind. There's just no excuse for it, Chris. It's very distressing, and we need to point the finger at Stuart Pearce. I hate to say it. He's a popular guy, but we're not better off with him than we were when he started there. And additionally, we have serious striker problems. We just can't finish on a consistent basis, and it's very disappointing that the club wasn't more aggressive in the January transfer window that could bring someone in to help. We did go after Mito, Chris, but we shouldn't have put all of our eggs in that basket. It turned out at the 11th hour, Mito and or Tottenham decided to pull out of that arrangement.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't look too promising. I mean, hopefully City can stay up and hopefully make it through to the August transfer window, and at that point try to get a permanent striker. But I mean, do you see Samaras staying? Do you see Karadi staying? Do you see any of the current strikers staying with the club, perhaps?
Potentially. Samaras, I believe, should stay because of his age, and he's still young and has loads of potential. Supporters are down on his desire and work ethic, but he does have loads of potential. I believe he deserves another season at City. I'm not so sure about Karate, who is getting up there in age as well as Vassell. I'd love to see us go after someone such as David Nugent, who plays in Northwest England, is one of the stars in the Championship, and is looking to elevate his career, especially if Preston doesn't make it to the Premiership next season.
So what about Stuart Pearce and the future of his position there at Manchester City, and also in relation to the England under-21 job?
Yes, this has really been interesting, Chris, because I go back and forth, as I think a lot of supporters struggle with. He's such a popular guy and likable, a legend of the game in England. After Christmas break, I was very happy, for him to stay there in the long term. But now we're back in a very poor run of form. So I'm not so sure anymore. And the under 21 issues don't bother me as much. I mean, I think it would have been good for the club actually if he were to take that job full time and also manage City. I think for the recruiting and marketing efforts of just having our manager be exposed to the leading young talent in the country on a regular basis, I'm not as sold on the fact that would have been a significant conflict of interest time management wise, but. So I don't agree with the club's stance there with respect to that, but if the club had an ulterior motive, they're trying to force him out, and therefore they're making an issue of the under-21 position, then I could see why they took the stance that they did.
So how do you think it'll play out? I mean, do you think it'll be that Stuart Pearce will get the under-21 job maybe in the summer and retain his position as City manager?
As far as City, I think that it really depends on the Premiership form in the coming weeks. I think it's really up in the air, and we need to finish strongly. We dropped like a rock, as you may recall, last season in the league, which was very embarrassing, and I don't think he can afford to do that again, even if we do stay up. So I think it really depends on the last few fixtures in the Premiership, and I do fancy his chances long-term in the under-21 job. They seem to have come to an awkward compromise solution in the near term with respect to that, but I could see him staying in that post permanently, especially if he's not going to be with City next season.
So what about the feeling among the fans at Manchester City? I mean, is it one of hopeful optimism? Or
It never seems to be that way, Chris, which is quite frustrating for me. I mean, I can relate to that on one hand. But on the other hand, we just beat Preston recently. It was a rare glimmer of hope this season. It was one of our best results all season, especially the way we came from behind in a hostile environment. On the road, and an important fixture for us. But You know, I listened to 606 and Soccer Shout, and it continues to be negativity from City supporters, just slagging on our strikers for their inability to finish. And I wish we could just at least appreciate a good result for a change instead of the continued negativity.
And for me personally, it's kind of a little bit sad, a little bit depressing, just watching the matches at the City of Manchester Stadium and just seeing the amount of empty seats. And it seems that as the season has progressed, those empty seats have become larger and larger. And it just seems to be a really kind of, almost like kind of a soulless stadium, unfortunately. And thinking back just a couple of seasons ago, or even a season ago, it was, Kevin Keegan, for all his faults and but also his positives, at least it seemed to be a more exciting team to watch, a little bit more kind of attacking minded, and now it seems to be almost it's that you'd think with Stuart Pearce that they would become more defensive, which they have done a lot of nil-nil ties throughout the season, especially earlier part of the season, but they're just missing that killer instinct in front of goal, it seems.
I concur, and we seem to miss an identity on the pitch, as I think you alluded to, if I could sum it up. But still, I think we should stop and appreciate the good results. You know, we do have a lot to be proud of. Most City supporters that I know have a big chip on their shoulder, and it bothers them to be overshadowed by United. But we are in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup. That's something to look forward to, and we've got a chance. I'm excited about it personally.
Excellent. Well, Brian, thanks so much for being on the show. If it's okay with you, maybe later on in the season, towards the end of the season, we can have talk to you again and see exactly where the championship is and get an update. And then, again, we look forward to the Championship Talk podcast this summer.
It will be my pleasure to be back on, especially, as you said, the race for the playoffs heats up in the championship. And the playoff final technically is the richest football match of the season in the world every season as far as what is at stake.
So thanks to Brian for being on the show. Stay tuned to future episodes of this podcast to hear about the new podcast entitled Championship Talk, which will premiere this June. Our London EPL Talk correspondent, Kevin Jones, meanwhile, will return next week. So if you have anything you'd like to get off your chest, or you have some feedback in regards to the podcast or any of our guests, you can go ahead and leave us a voicemail, and we'll pick the best ones and put them on the next show. The phone number to call in the United States is area code 206, and the number then is 203-4649. Again, it's 206-203-4649. So we have now come to the part of the show that many of you have been waiting for. In last week's episode, you had a chance to win a copy of the Pro Evolution Soccer 2007 video game, courtesy of Konami. So we received many responses from you, the listeners. So let me go ahead and pick out the winner out of the hat right now. And let me just mix up all the names, close my eyes, put my hand in, pick out the winner. And the winner of the game is Lee Calmaestro. Congratulations, Lee. And also, if you didn't win that, of course, we do have two World Soccer Shop t-shirts that we're giving away to the runners-up. So the first runner-up is Philip Blodgett. And the second runner-up and winner of the World Soccer Shop t-shirt is Evan Garcia from Long Beach, California. So if you're one of those winners, please go ahead and email me, and I'll send out those prizes to you. So speaking of World Soccer Shop, you can buy official shirts for all 20 Premiership clubs at the EPL Talk store. Just visit eptalk.com and click on the store link to find the shirts and much more footy merchandise. So that's all the time we have for this Chock-a-Block episode. If you like what you hear, please go ahead and support the show by posting a review on iTunes, voting for us on dig.com, which is digg.com/podcasts, and taking the listener survey from the EPL Talk podcast page via eplTalk.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great week, and we'll be back next week with another high-profile guest. Take care.